This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Until recently, most of us didn't give much thought to homegrown hate groups. Many believed they had disappeared. But as we learned during the recent rally in Charlottesville, those groups have been here all along, lurking in the background and in the dark corners of the internet. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks these groups, estimates there are 917 of them, maybe more, currently operating in the United States. 31 of them are here in North Carolina. The number of these groups is growing, and there is concern that media coverage of the rally in particular and those groups in general will lead to more people joining. So what makes these groups attractive? Do they target the same individuals who could easily be recruited into ISIS? What do they believe? What are their goals? And why do these groups feel newly emboldened to emerge from the shadows? We take a look at that with Ryan Lenz. He's the senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he joins us by phone from Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Peter Simme is director of the Earl Babby Research Center and an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Chapman University in Orange, California. He studies extremist groups and their psychology and is author of American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. And he comes to us via Skype. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And with us in our Spirit Square studio is Dr. John Cox, Associate Professor of Global Studies and Director of the Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies at UNC Charlotte and the author of To Kill a People, Genocide in the 20th Century. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to be here.
Let me ask all three of you this question, and I guess I'll begin with you, Ryan. Did the emergence of these groups, the sudden emergence of these groups, surprise you?
Not really, because I don't think it was so much of a sudden emergence. You know, we've been seeing steady growth in hate groups for years, most notably in the aftermath of President Obama's election. After the 2008 election, hate groups and anti-government extremist organizations literally rose through the roof. There was something incredibly divisive about the reality of having our first African-American president. And over the course of the 8 years of that administration, they continue to hold strong. So when the Trump phenomenon or the Trump movement began with President Trump riding down the escalator in Trump Tower and saying that, that Mexico was sending us criminals and rapists, this movement was ready to hear that. And it found itself just on fire.
Hmm. Dr. Simme, same question. I guess you saw, since you studied these hate groups, you saw their growth during the Obama years, and I guess it's the election of President Trump and some of his rhetoric that emboldened them?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things in doing field work with active members of these groups is, and your opening touched on this, is hiding in the shadows. These folks are good at engaging in more hidden acts of kind of resistance to help keep themselves going, where they have small gatherings and come together with like-minded folks. And that really kind of helps, sustain their beliefs and their sense of community. But really, during that period of time, they were kind of waiting for an opening, waiting for a moment that they felt was kind of ripe for the picking. And as Ryan talks about that moment of now President Trump coming down the escalator, that seemed to fit the bill for them. And now we're seeing a more kind of public manifestation of these folks.
Same question. Surprise you?
I agree with the comments of our other two guests. And I'll just add that, I was not surprised by the events in Charlottesville. Or by the rise, which the Southern Poverty Law Center has done a great job of documenting, of hate groups. Also, they've done an excellent job on monitoring hate crimes against Muslims over the last few years and the emergence of anti-Muslim groups. But also, I grew up in Greensboro, and I was a teenager in Greensboro when the Ku Klux Klan and some Nazis came in and shot and killed five people not far from me in 1979. So I've always been aware that these groups existed. And in fact, they get their sustenance from the swamp of white supremacy, of diluted types of grievances that are shared by many white folks, I'm sorry to say. And so there's always been not only activity, but there's always been the potential for an explosion of
activity.
We're
going to talk about that, the reasons why they want to be part of this and some of these grievances that they have, real or imagined. Heidi Byrick, Ryan, I hope I said her name correctly. She's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, which monitors hate activity online. She told CBS News that the Southern Poverty Law Center, in all their years of tracking hate groups, has never seen this many hate groups. She said, we've never seen their ideas penetrating the mainstream the way they are. I would say most Americans don't realize how much of this there is. Wow. But in terms of numbers and what damage they can inflict with those numbers, how concerned should we be?
Well, I mean, I think we should be concerned because what we've seen is, the slow but rapidly quickening acceptance of extremist ideologies into the mainstream of American politics. We have, we've seen policies that are literally, fantasies and dreams of the white nationalist movement be sort of roll out in this administration. We see, extremists, David Duke to Matt Limbaugh, be very, very excited about the realities of politics in America today. That's not by accident, and that's certainly not a delusion on their part. We've seen the mainstream of hate and extremism.
So what should concern us more, Dr. Cox? The fact that these groups have been in existence, hiding in the shadows, forever. I mean, they've been there forever. Or the fact that they have now emerged. What should concern us more?
I guess I'll take the easy route and say maybe equally. But, yeah, we should be concerned, and there's been a lot of attention to the rise and increased visibility since last November or even before then when the Trump campaign obviously gave a lot of encouragement. It emboldened racists and fascists who've been out there for some time, and it attracted more people to their movements and so on. But again, I'm glad that Ryan Lentz pointed out earlier that the election of Obama was also kind of a turning point, I think, in an intensification, because it fed into, you referred earlier to grievances, real or imagined, and there's an imagined grievance among many white people. There was a poll that came out about a year ago that said that 53% of white American adults believed that they suffer more persecution and discrimination than black folks do. When I saw that poll, I knew that Trump had a chance to get elected because that showed the depths of of delusions and grievances and anxieties and resentments.
Is that part of what you look into, Dr. Simi, when you talk about the psychology of these groups and the people who are attracted to them, these grievances that they have, real or imagined?
Yeah, absolutely. The groups themselves are very good at really promoting this idea that, everything is upside down, especially in the post-World War II era. Everything has been kind of turned upside down to where, whites as a race are on the verge of extinction, right? And there's this genocide that's being persecuted against whites. And so white people will cease to exist because of this, and that white culture is completely under attack. And so there's a strong sense of persecution, of victimization that goes along with what these groups are kind of promoting and the propaganda that they produce and distribute.
You're not alone, Dr. Cox, in saying that the election of Donald Trump has encouraged and emboldened racists and bigots to come out of the closet. But is it really what Trump voters voted for, or is this just a tiny subset of voters?
Right. I think that's a good question because that can be exaggerated. People voted for him for a lot of reasons, although people who voted for him had to overlook a lot of things. Of course, a lot of people vote because maybe their families always voted Republican or whatever, or because of their hostility toward Hillary Clinton and for other reasons. But again, one also really had to overlook the overt racism and xenophobia of the Trump campaign. So I think that, again, racism comes in a lot of different shades. Not everyone who harbors racial grievances and anxieties is wearing a white hood.
Do you think everybody saw what he said or some of the things that he said as being overtly racist or xenophobic, or did it just wash over them?
Well, I'd say to make it succinct, because these are all questions we could talk about for hours, but I'll get the wrap-up signal from you if I try. But I would say that there's also, I think, a real problem is that a large percentage of the adult population watches Fox News. And really, if you watch Fox News for 20 years, even if you're not a real politically conscious, active person, you're absorbing a lot of things about how the black folks, the Muslims, the Mexicans are taking over. There's a really good book called Strangers in the Land by someone named Hochschild that came out a year ago. And she talks about the phenomenon of cutting in line. Like, I've been working hard. Now these other people, because of affirmative action or whatever, are cutting in line.
Andrew Breitbart, who founded Breitbart News, the late Andrew Breitbart, said that if you change the media and you change what you see in the culture of entertainment, that politics will follow, because media and entertainment is the leading edge of all of that. Is that what is happening here, Dr. Simi? We're seeing Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, constant coverage of a president who's out of the mold of other presidents, now beginning to change the culture, and this is catching fire with people who either simmered in the background or who were there for the taking but never really thought about it until we started talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have a lot of things going on there. You know, when you talk about the, you know, Fox News and their prominence in in some of their viewers' lives, who that is their only source of information, or some of the AM radio talk like Rush Limbaugh, and entire stations that are literally dedicated to you know, that political stream of thought, and that's all they air. If that's all you're listening to, then obviously that can have a big impact.
But would you characterize Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and some of the other AM radio talk show hosts really as being purveyors of white supremacy, or simply people who are angry at the status quo, angry at liberalism, and want to see a more conservative bent in the country?
Well, I wouldn't put it in a box to say that this is just solely white supremacy. I think it's more complicated than that. But if you listen to the language, I listen to Rush Limbaugh on a regular basis. I watch news on a regular – I watch Fox News on a regular basis. I listen to Sean Hannity because I want to understand the different perspectives. And a lot of the language is so polarizing and talks about – liberals as essentially this kind of contaminating force. And if you were to then go on to say something like Stormfront, the largest white supremacist web forum, or similar sites, you do find some strong similarities in the kind of language and the way in which kind of alternate perspectives are dehumanized and certain kind of groups are dehumanized. There certainly are some important parallels.
Ryan, Southern Poverty Law Center has been studying this for a long time. You've been witnessing the rise of this movement in the background for a long time. Can you correlate it to the rise in the popularity of right-wing media?
Well, I think that the two are sort of somewhat symbiotic. You know, if we look at what has happened in the last 2 years, not just in terms of the rise of hate groups and extremism nationwide, but also in terms of some major political and cultural changes, I don't think you can discount the role of right-wing media. Coming into this campaign, coming into this presidential campaign in 2016, Donald Trump effectively delegitimized the reality of the news media. You know, and what we saw come up behind it, or rather in its stead, was this constellation of very loud, very antagonistic and oftentimes very false reports coming from right-wing media outlets online. It's a reality that it provides this echo chamber that has fed the ideology, led to lots of people believing things that are not true, ideas such as white genocide, which is a ever-present reality on the radical right. And it's going to be a little bit of a difficult. Trying to get out of it.
And let me stop you there, because we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Southern Ideal Home Show, September 8th through 10th at the Park Expo and Conference Center, featuring bath ideas and advice from Matt Minster of HDTV's Bath Crashers. Tickets at charlottehomeshow.com. And Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, serving the people of North Carolina for 84 years. Blue Cross North Carolina offers dozens of health plans and provides access to thousands of in-network doctors. Well, the Panthers tied the NFL last season for the most players with concussions and the most games missed because of them. And just as training camp got underway this season, an alarming report showed the prevalence of the degenerative brain disease CTE among deceased players. It's been a decade since the league first acknowledged the long-term effects of concussion. So what have they done since to make the game safer? And can football ever really be safe? That discussion on this program tomorrow at 9.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, mandatory evacuations underway in Houston and Louisiana as Harvey rolls on. We'll go inside the tough call to evacuate a city. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rise of the alt-right, particularly white supremacist and neo-Nazi movements around the country, with Ryan Lentz, senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center, Dr. Peter Simi, director of the Earl Babbie Research Center at Chapman University and author of American Swastika, the Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate, and Dr. John Cox, director of the Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies at UNC Charlotte, and author of To Kill a People, Genocide in the 20th Century. Dr. Simi, you've been studying these hate groups for 20 years. You've conducted interviews with members of these groups. What strikes you most about these individual people when you speak to them in person?
Well, I think it's important to point out that ironically enough, a diverse lot. They come from a lot of different kinds of backgrounds. I think we kind of have some common misconceptions or even maybe stereotypes about who gets involved in these kind of groups. I think we like to think in terms of a person who poorly educated, not very intellectually inclined, lower socioeconomic status. And in fact, what you find is just a really broad cross-section of folks who get involved at varying levels of affluence and varying levels of educational backgrounds, doctors, lawyers, engineers, and just all across the spectrum. I also just want to build on this earlier point that we were just discussing as far as the talk radio on Fox. One of the things that's interesting, if you listen to a lot of white supremacists in terms of what they're saying about President Trump, many of them are saying, really, he's a first step. It's not that they're saying he's one of us, but they're saying really he's an important first step. And I think that also goes to kind of this idea that it's not necessarily that they're looking for everything to be exactly in line with what they want, but they're looking for leverage. They're looking for ways of pushing the system in the direction that they want to go.
What are they looking for? As you study these people, Ryan, report on them, and the Southern Poverty Law Center looks at them over the years. What are their goals? In their perfect world, what would the world be like?
Well, I think the United States would be divided into a series of what they call ethno-states, a place where whites could live with whites alone, and every other race would be relegated or segregated to its own part of the country. They want a country that is homogeneously white.
And they're not alone. We'll talk about this a little bit later on. There are black groups that want the country to be all black. We'll talk about them a little later on here. These hate groups have been around forever. Are they the foundation of the so-called alt-right movement, Dr. Cox?
Yeah, it's possible that one of our other guests could speak with more knowledge of that. But the alt-right is kind of a loose and slippery term that's used in different ways. And it's used often by people like Richard Spencer. The gathering that took place 2.5 weeks ago in Charlottesville was kind of under the rubric of alt-right, but included a lot of people that fall under a lot of other categories by people who study them, such as neo-Confederates and other people that I would call fascists, okay. Nazis, et cetera. And the alt-right is in some ways an effort to rebrand some elements of these things.
Let's define some things here then, because this could get very sticky and dangerous if we don't know what we're talking about or don't know what we're listening to. How do these white supremacists differ from the alt-right movement? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of. So jump in there and take it.
I'd say there's a lot of overlap is what I'd say, but I think, again, Ryan might have some more detail, but there's a lot of overlap, and it's difficult, and certainly anyone within the alt-right is almost certainly is a white supremacist.
Ryan?
Well, I mean, so for the better part of two decades now, and I'm sure Pete can talk about this as well, you know, white nationalists in the United States have struggled to figure out how to, you know, what to call themselves, you know, a label under which they can all unite for the purposes of moving into the mainstream and establishing some sort of political legitimacy. You know, they've toyed around with the idea of like white supremacists, and then early on they did race realists. That was a Jared Taylor favorite. Then they went to white nationalists, which was an idea that was favorable for a long while. And along comes Richard Spencer, who claims to have coined the phrase, but it was really coined by a racist named Paul Gottfried. And under that banner of the alt-right, they were able to bring in a whole bunch of people, both young and old, who felt that this was their path to political power.
And we haven't talked a lot about this in recent years, probably the last 40 years, but let's talk just for a second, Dr. Simi, about what it means to be a fascist and what it means to be either a Nazi, a Hitler Nazi, or a neo-Nazi. What are the differences?
Well, well, I mean, neo-Nazis you usually refer to folks kind of post-World War II who kind of took up the banner of Nazism in the United States. We would refer to, for instance, the American Nazi Party founded by George Lincoln Rockwell and similar efforts, other organizations along those lines. And they you know, there's obviously, we would say a neo-Nazi is a type of white supremacist, really, by default. But neo-Nazis really put a strong emphasis on Nazi Germany, Adolf Hitler, symbols related to Nazi Germany, oftentimes donning some type of organizational uniforms that have some resemblance to Nazi uniforms. So that's really there's a strong focus on the Nazis as compared to, say, the Ku Klux Klan, which until much more recently didn't do that. And then in the 70s, many Klans became kind of Nazified, you might say.
And what do they identify with within the Nazi belief system? What are they looking for? I'm sorry, go ahead.
First and foremost, racial purity. This idea of racial purity is really central. Blood and culture, these ideas are really kind of foundational. And really kind of moving towards a racial utopian society where you have racial nation states.
And when we talk about fascism, Dr. Cox, what are we saying? What is that system? What were Hitler and Mussolini trying to build under fascism?
Right. Well, they were, what the previous speaker said, more so for Hitler than for Mussolini, racial purity was at the center of it. Mussolini incorporated that more in the later 1930s, although there was also always a strong element of racism. Fascism picks up a lot of the characteristics of its national culture, so therefore fascism was less... was more anti-Semitic in some countries, such as Germany, than in others. But I'd say a couple of things that distinguish fascism from traditional far-right authoritarian movements or ideologies is some things that we do see some elements of today, such as a cult of the leader, a false populism that we are on your side. This was a key element of the Nazis' appeal. If you look at their election posters in 1932, it didn't say vote for us, we're going to kill all the Jews. It said vote for us, we're the last hope of the unemployed and so on.
Yes, inflation was rampant, unemployment mm-hmm. was high in Germany. There was a lot of loss of hope by the rank and file working people in Germany at the time, which made Hitler's promises very, very attractive, correct?
Yes, that's quite correct. Yeah, the Depression hit, they kind of come out of the economic crisis in the early 20s, but then were hit very hard by the Great Depression. Mm. And there were very large socialist and communist parties, so the Nazis also knew they had to make some kind of a false appeal to working class people that we are on your side and so on. But there's also kind of a dynamism and a mobilization that's part of fascism that distinguishes it from other forms of right-wing politics.
There was a recent Vice News special about hate groups. Several of the people mm-hmm. they spoke with talked openly about the possible need for violence and their willingness to kill people if necessary. That documentary has been viewed over 44 million times. And here's Vice News reporter L. Reeve asking Christopher Cantwell, a white nationalist speaker at the Unite the Right rally, what the death of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville will mean to the alt-right movement.
What do you think this means for the next alt-right protest?
I say it's going to be really tough to top, but we're up to the challenge.
Wait, why?
Why?
Tough to top. I mean, someone died.
I think that a lot more people are going to die before we're done here, frankly.
Why?
Why? Because people die every day, right? I mean,
like of a heart attack. I mean, violent death.
Well, people die violent deaths all the time, right? Like, this is part of the reason that we want an ethno state, right? So, like, the blacks are killing each other in staggering numbers from coast to coast. We don't really want to have a part of that anymore. And so the fact that they resist us when we say, hey, we want a homeland, is not shocking to me, all right? These people want violence, and the right is just meeting market demand.
That sounds callous, crazy, and I don't even have a word for it. I'm sure you've all heard this before if you've studied these groups or talked to members of these groups. What was your reaction when you heard that, Dr. Cox?
Yeah, I watched that video. It's a very well-done video. That idiot Cantwell got himself in trouble, I think, for speaking too much. I think he may have been arrested yesterday. Again, that actually didn't surprise me because I've seen enough of these groups, and did I know that that's their outlook. But again, one quick point I'll try to make, though, is that what we saw in Charlottesville and elsewhere is a very ugly face and an outrageous face of deeper problems that exist, and that exist in more mundane ways, except for people who are affected by them.
Deeper problems,
such as, I know you all had a show on gentrification the other day, and so I'm just saying you often have shows on criminal justice and mass incarceration and things like this. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying there are a million ways in which racism functions in this country. But to people who don't suffer from it, it functions often in less visible and more polite manners. But that's all. That is all too, I think, a bedrock for the appearance of these sorts of groups.
How are these, Ryan Lenz? How are these groups different from gangs? They're out marching in the streets now. They advocate violence. They don't mind killing people. At least they say they don't mind killing people. How is that different from the gangs that we go after on the streets today?
Well, I think it's different in one way. They've got a political end in mind. Gangs are generally there are some similarities. I think in terms of the violence, but there are vast differences in terms of what unites the members and what they ultimately see as their goal.
And back in the day, when the Ku Klux Klan marched, they would march in white robes and hoods. They would cover their faces. The members of the Klan that marched in Charlottesville did not cover their faces. And we live in an era where we now have facial identification software, so you can't really be anonymous if a camera picks you up in many cases. Why do they feel that they don't need the hoods anymore, Dr. Simi?
Well, I think this is that, you know, kind of that emboldening, you know, part of this kind of coming out of the shadows, coming out of the corners where, you know, these folks do feel like, you know, this is a political opportunity that needs to be seized, and they need to do this in a very overt and open manner. And this is the time is right.
Are the beliefs of the Ku Klux Klan, Ryan, different today than they were 150 years ago?
Not at all. Not at all. And if I could expand on the answer and your previous question, I think one of the main reasons they don't want to hide their faces anymore, which is considerably different from what the Klan was in the 20s, by the way, is because they're not ashamed. They are feeling that this is the moment where they have, you know, the biggest megaphone, the biggest political megaphone they've ever had, and that there's no reason to hide from these beliefs anymore. And I think there's a notable moment that actually defined or showed this shift. It was during the RNC convention in Cleveland. You know, Richard Spencer, who leads the alt-right, one of the leaders of the alt-right, he stood outside the convention with a poster board that had the question written on it that said, "Want to speak to a racist?" And the word racist was in single quotes. And he was out there answering any question that anyone would want to ask him. And he was hoping to have the world stage at the event, and it showed us that the racists are not ashamed of their beliefs anymore. They're not going to hide from them anymore. They believe this is the moment to take the country back in their favor.
And you say, Dr. Cox, that these beliefs, these ideologies, are baked in to the culture. You said that they are embedded in our cultural history, as well as our political and economic institutions. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, I don't like to boil it down to a slogan, but the fact is that this country was founded on ethnic cleansing, displacement, and genocide of Native peoples, a process that continued in very violent forms throughout the 19th century and that still exists today in different ways. Slavery and racism, obviously, are the original sins and still integral to this society. And I think many people now are raised with the myth that after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, there was a period of Jim Crow, but then because we have such a great country, a couple of great people stood forward, Martin Luther King Jr. and LBJ, and then those matters were solved. And so, and so over the last 50 years, after Obama was elected, you hear terms like post-racial. We now live in a post-racial society. But there are all sorts of economic and statistics and statistics from criminal justice that demonstrate, for example, a black person is 22 times more likely to be shot by the police, 16 times more likely to end up serving long periods of jail for drug possession, even though whites and blacks use drugs in equal proportion, and so on and so on. And then there are many other less visible and demonstrated ways. So I would just say that essentially our founding fathers, there's an excellent book called Stamped from the Beginning by Ibram Kendi that won a bunch of awards. It was published about a year ago. But he goes through an intellectual and political history of the manner in which, again, racism has formed the institutions and leading ideologies.
Let me ask a very unpolitically correct question. I'm sure this is absolutely true in certain parts of the country, but probably not everywhere. But how involved in alt-right or white supremacist or even Klan beliefs are some members of police departments?
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that I was in Greensboro. I was 16 years old when the Klan and Nazis shot those people. They also had two police informants who were part of that. Now, I'm sorry, the other gentleman could probably speak with more detail, but in the past, it was quite widespread, well into the 1960s, and even up to the present day, there's lesser incidents, but it's been well documented that it was very close.
I think, Dr. Simi, you wanted to chime in on that.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, this is a good example of how deeply entrenched the problem of white supremacy is in our society. If you trace the history of policing in the United States, one of the early points of origin are slave patrols, right. And then if you move forward in time, you know, you can find police departments that were heavily overlapping with local Klan groups. And that's, I don't say that just in terms of the South either. I mean, even departments like the Los Angeles Police Department, that Chief Parker, was an avowed white supremacist who would recruit from Klan groups in his efforts to, quote unquote, reform the LAPD. And now just this week, a small town in Oklahoma, the newly appointed, I think he was interim chief, and Ryan might have some more details on this, was discovered to be a white supremacist who had been helping run the group Blood and Honor here in the United States for years and had just recently had to step down.
Ryan, if you want to comment on that, we'll have to wait till after the break. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure.
Okay, well, we'll come back and do that in just a moment. We have to take a break. We're here with Dr. Peter Simi, who you just heard speaking, who's the author of American Swastika, and John Cox is here from UNC Charlotte. To Kill a People is the name of his book, and Ryan Lentz is a senior investigative reporter for Southern Poverty Law Center. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Baby & Company, a modern birth center offering individualized maternity and well-woman care classes and wellness services in an intimate setting. More information available at babyandcompany.com. And Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at The View near BB&T Ballpark in Uptown Charlotte and at Birkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wine and beer from all over the world. Relax, uncork, unwind. TheScrewCrew.com. Mandatory evacuations are underway in Houston and Louisiana as Harvey continues to roll on. Inside, the tough call to evacuate a city, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes during On Point. On the anniversary of the shooting of Keith Scott, WFAE is hosting a public conversation, Unrest in the Queen City, 1 year later. You're invited to attend this discussion and public forum on September 20th, 7 to 9 p.m. at McGlowan Theater, and you can get details and register free at WFAE.org. We're coming right back.
What can be done to compel Charlottesians to regularly be with residents of different races, classes, lifestyles, and beliefs? A listener submitted that question to the WFAE newsroom through our Ask Us feature, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on the topic. Have you found ways to interact with people different from you? What gets you there, or what gets in the way? Share your thoughts by leaving a message at 704-879-3536 or by going online to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Ryan Lentz from the Southern Poverty Law Center, Dr. Peter Simi from Chapman University, Dr. John Cox from UNC Charlotte. We were talking about how many people in law enforcement might be members or hold some of the similar beliefs to these groups on the right. And Ryan, I think you were going to chime in on that from the Southern Poverty Law Center point of view.
Sure, yeah. That's a persistent worry, because we know that there are law enforcement officers who have been radicalized or taken in by extremist ideologies. It's not always racist ideologies that we're concerned with. In many instances, we're worried about those police officers who've taken in with the anti-government patriot movement, which was considerably large under Obama as well, and has continued to to exist despite historic models that suggest it would shrink in a time of a Republican administration. There are groups like the Oath Keepers, which actively works to recruit police officers and law enforcement, military personnel, first responders, firemen, for the purposes of indoctrinating them with an ideology that says the federal government may seek to undermine the Constitution, and you should be willing to defy orders, thereby putting the rule of law in your own hands, to stand up to the federal government. It's a terrifying reality that we're living in, where we know for a fact that over 30,000 law enforcement officers, military personnel, and first responders are part of this organization. So it's nothing to laugh at.
I think a key thing, very quickly, is that, for example, you said and share similar beliefs. The New York City Police Department probably doesn't have a lot of people with a Klan suit in their closet, but it's people there will tell you, and I live there, and I know other people who suffered racism directly, whereas I'm only an observer and a researcher, but that their practices daily and attitudes are deeply racist.
Americans have been wringing their hands over ISIS and al-Qaeda recruiting American citizens into their beliefs and into their organizations and encouraging them to do homegrown terrorist acts in this country. Is the allure to these hate groups the same? Does it attract the same kind of individual appeal to people who have similar needs or desires? Dr. Simi, maybe.
There do appear to be some overlaps. One of the things we found in interviewing about 100 former white supremacists here in the U.S. is that there are some commonalities in terms of kind of background issues as far as susceptibility. Pretty high number report things like experiencing child abuse, physical, sexual abuse, unstable family background, substance abuse in the families, parental neglect, and then during adolescence, further instabilities emerge in their own kind of conduct, where they're acting out, having problems at school, having problems with other forms of misconduct. And so the extremism kind of when they get exposed to that, during adolescence or early adulthood, it's kind of in some ways a coping mechanism for this downward spiral that they're on. And you see that with some of the cases in terms of foreign fighters, some of the recent attacks in Europe, some of the folks, the attackers, have similar kind of background profiles.
These groups would not call themselves hate groups, should we?
That's probably the gentleman, Ryan Lenz, is probably best equipped. I'll just say quickly, though, I think sometimes the hate groups can be a little bit...
They have a different ideology.
It's a little imprecise.
They have a different ideology than the mainstream culture. At least we think it's the mainstream culture. So, but should we be referring to them as hate groups, Ryan?
Well, I mean, look at what the definition of a hate group is. And I think that you'll start to see that all of these groups that we define as such fall in line. You know, we define a hate group as an organization which seeks to vilify, demean, harass, or intimidate, otherwise attack a group of people based on a characteristic, you know, based on an immutable characteristic, something they can't change. Now, this definition has come under fire in recent years, especially as we included some anti-LGBT organizations, which they argued, you know, that we were attacking these groups or labeling them as hate mongers based on their faith, and that is false. You know, in that instance, we didn't list these organizations because they opposed same-sex marriage, for example. We listed these organizations because they attacked a class of people based on an immutable characteristic. They peddled false theory, junk science about the LGBT community, saying that gay men were more likely to be pedophiles and such. And so the definition of hate is not sort of variable per the group. It is consistent throughout.
The Southern Poverty Law Center estimates, and I gave this number out at the very beginning, 917 hate groups in America. And then I read something yesterday that increased that number somewhat. It's a rather specific number either way. How did you arrive at the number?
Well, every year we undertake a year-long process, really, of surveying the landscape, so to speak, looking at extremist publications, websites, groups, to understand what groups are out there and active and what groups are not. It changes from year to year. Groups that were listed in 2015 might not be listed, or groups that were listed in 2016 might not be listed in 2017 if they've fallen off the radar. But it's the best look that we have to understand how thoroughly seated extremist ideologies are in the world and where they exist.
So in the 917 plus groups, how many members would that constitute? How many people does that constitute? Or do we know?
Well, that's the barrier, because we don't have membership lists for these organizations. We don't know how many people belong to any given group, for example. And furthermore, we don't know what exists in the minds of citizens across the country, you know, the people who hold hardcore racist ideas. Mm-hmm. And this has created a shift we're seeing right now in just the makeup of hate in America. And let me add one point on this. The idea of a hate group, the historic concept of a hate group, is somewhat changing because of communication tools and means we have with the internet. A person can be radicalized online by themselves without ever going to a meeting, without ever paying dues for a hate group, without ever saying, sitting and talking with extremists and being taught lessons. They can teach themselves this lesson. And I think most poignantly or most terrifyingly, one of the most terrifying examples would be Dylann Roof. Dylann Roof didn't go to a meeting. He didn't talk to anyone who was active in the hate scene. He Googled the phrase. He Googled the phrase black on white crime. And per his own writings, he said he was never the same afterward. It plunged him into this perverse rabbit hole of curiosity that spit him out, a changed human being with skewed ideas about race and culture, American history, and others. And that's the trouble here.
And you say that there are 31 of these hate groups in North Carolina. We rank 11th in the nation in the number of hate groups. I think Virginia ranks 5th in the nation for the number of hate groups. Are these groups particular to the South, or are they all over the country pretty much?
Well, they're all over the country, but there are a few things we can take away from from the hate map year to year. And one of the things that we notice is that the vast majority of hate groups exist in populated areas that have diverse populations, coastal areas.
And the bigger the population, the more groups or the more membership involved, because it correlates with people, right?
It does seem to look that way. You're right. I mean, like if you look at the states that have the largest numbers, you've got California, you've got New York, you've got all in Florida, but the most populous areas that are most populated by hate groups are the West Coast and the Southeast.
Since the beginning of this conversation, we've had a Twitter comment on the screen here that I want to get to, and that is this. Why don't people condemn the group Antifa? Let's talk about that, because until all
let me jump in on that, because we get asked that a lot.
Well, hold on. Until this rally in Charlottesville, I'd never heard of Antifa before. Have they been around for a while, Ryan?
Yeah, the anti-fascist movement sprung up in Germany, and it has, you know, sort of swept the world. And we've seen it sort of slowly emerge in America in response to, of course, increased hate groups and increased hate crimes. The Antifa movement has, you know, it's this sort of, again, this loosely organized grassroots effort to push back what they see as the rise of fascism in America. And they really started to make headlines earlier this year with protests in Berkeley, where protesters showed up, counter-protesters showed up to white nationalist rallies for the purposes of shutting them down, making them, you know, speaking their voice, exercising their First Amendment, just as the racists were claiming to do. But as the situation has intensified, and by that I mean as the political culture in America has polarized, this group has chosen to become violent, by any means necessary, as they frequently say, to shut down racist speech in the public space.
Yes, well, of course, Antifa is short for anti-fascist. I'm proud to say that I was a member of an anti-fascist and anti-racist organization in Berlin when I lived for a couple of years in Berlin about 15 years ago. So I think it's Antifa also means a lot of different things. There's a lot of different people. There's not like some central organizing, group of Antifa. A lot of people identify themselves as Antifa because they say that I'm anti-fascist and I'm prepared, and so I protest against the Nazis and the fascists. You can also, if you Google up Cornel West, Charlottesville, Antifa, you'll see Cornel West and other people talking about the role of Antifa activists in Charlottesville 2.5 weeks ago of protecting people from the coordinated violent attacks of the racist and Nazis.
We heard Christopher Cantwell. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just—it's curious. I had noticed that it seems like people have a tendency when we do start to focus or talk about or discuss white supremacists, there's a common response is, why aren't you talking about ISIS or Islamic terrorism? Why aren't you talking about Black Lives Matter? Why aren't you talking about anti-fascist? Why aren't you talking about anything but white supremacists?
Right.
And I think that just really reflects how deeply entrenched this problem is and how much denial there is and unwillingness to go there.
Well, that leads into the question I was going to ask. Is this pushback on the part of groups like Antifa all that necessary? And we already heard from Christopher Cantwell, who said that they're willing to kill people to have their beliefs persist or grow. And then he was on that Vice News documentary, and Robert Ray, who is a neo-Nazi and writer for the Daily Stormer website, which is a neo-Nazi website, spoke with Vice News reporter L. Reeve again about his beliefs while explaining what he and his cohorts thought they would get out of the Charlottesville rally.
For one thing, it means that we're showing to this parasitic class of anti-white vermin that this is our country. This country was built by our forefathers. It's sustained by us. It's going to remain our country. I believe, as you can see, we are stepping off the internet in a big way. For instance, last night at the Torch Walk, there were hundreds and hundreds of us. People realize they're not atomized individuals. They're part of a larger whole because we have been spreading our memes. We have been organizing on the internet. And so now they're coming out. And now, as you can see today, we greatly outnumbered the anti-white, anti-American filth. And at some point, we will have enough power that we will clear them from the streets forever. That which is degenerate in white countries will be removed.
So you're saying showing up in physical space lets people know that, like, they're more like them.
We're, right? We're starting to slowly unveil a little bit of our power level. You ain't seen nothing yet.
So when you hear that, Dr. Simi, does that give justification to Antifa?
Well, it depends what part. I mean, if we're talking about you know, targeting individuals with unprovoked violence, then no. If we're talking about counter-protesting in a peaceful manner, then absolutely. If we're talking about self-defense, then absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, I think we need to sort these things out. But as far as unprovoked violence, that only helps these types of groups, these hate groups.
The vice president says, this is Mike Pence, these dangerous fringe groups have no place in American public life and in the American debate, and we condemn them in the strongest possible terms. And the governor of Virginia says, let's be honest, they need to leave America because they are not Americans. Are we at another impasse here, or is this such a minority of individuals that will get beyond this?
I'll just say for what it's worth, yeah, and some of those statements sound nice, and are the kind of statements a politician has to make at certain times, like after the murder of Heather Hager. But again, frankly, these types of politicians and most others are very much part of a system that is keeping racism alive. Well, and so I do believe we have to be more vigilant today because of the emboldenment of racists and fascists.
We hear it from most politicians, but not all. After Charlottesville, the president said
right.
racism is evil and that those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. That's Donald Trump. But then, he said,
yeah.
there were many sides to the demonstration and good people involved on both sides. Ryan, we have less than a minute. Can you have it both ways?
No, you can't. And I think it's important to remember the order in which those statements emerged.
Right.
The first statement you read was the last, and it was an effort on the part of the president to correct the earlier statement, which was the last one you read. This is one of the things that is so concerning to us to see, the inability or the reluctance to condemn this from the highest levels of power in the country, when that very office, has been largely responsible for offering a sense of legitimacy and authenticity to a movement now in the mainstream.
Right, and then in his August 15th press conference, Trump almost started waving a Confederate flag.
All right, we have to stop. We have out of time. I want to thank Ryan Lenz from the Southern Poverty Law Center, Dr. Peter Simi, author of American Swastika, and John Cox, author of To Kill a People, from Chapman University and UNC Charlotte, respectively, for being with us for the hour.